Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. Dr. Smith-Ryan, there still seems to be this misconception that for women, if you lift heavy weights, you're going to get bulky. It's been around for as long as I can remember, and to me it seems like there's no sign of it going anywhere. I was really interested to get your thoughts on where this myth comes from, why it persists, and then maybe following up by what the research that you're doing and have done actually shows around women and resistance training.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I wish if we lift heavy weights we would get bigger. I've been trying for a long time to do that, but you know, I don't know where the myth comes from. I have a hunch that it comes from a lot of the, you know, physique and bodybuilding female pictures that women see. But if we juxtapose that to what the literature shows, it needs to go away, because really women benefit the most from lifting heavy weights. But along with that, I often don't expect women just to go pick up heavy weights. Like, I think we need to do a better job of providing them the appropriate knowledge and education and removing some of those barriers. And so, you know, some of it comes from people like you. Is how do we remove it and talk about it? And the benefit to women, particularly as they age, is only accelerated when we lift heavier weights.
There's this common kind of message, I think, that is particularly aimed at women, but also increasingly men, of how it's kind of important to eat less and move more. But I think as we get older, and I'm hoping that this is something we can dive into, obviously maintaining muscle mass as we age is a huge correlatory effect with longevity. And we're not just talking about muscle mass, but obviously bone density, strength, and something that women traditionally do suffer from, you know, weaker bones and less muscle mass as they get older. Why do you think this message of kind of, you know, eat less, move more, should that be replaced? Should we all be thinking about let's lift heavy and eat enough? Is that a better message as we get a little bit older in terms of doing all those right things from a fitness perspective that have a crossover to a longevity perspective?
100%. I think, you know, even as much as I like to think I have some knowledge in this space, and even as much as I know, I still have to convince and remind myself, oh, like I need to eat more and lift heavy opposed to just expend calories. And I think some of it comes down to the foundational messages that we were told when we were younger, and even we still give to younger girls now, is that it's all about caloric expenditure. And so I think some of that, I don't know, you know, particularly in the US healthcare system, our physicians don't have a lot of that training related to exercise and nutrition. And it really comes down to expending calories, when in reality, there's a lot of metabolic adaptation that happens. And a lot of, you know, we have these guidelines of 10,000 steps or walking. And, you know, people are trying to do that, which is great. But a lot of what even my research focuses on is, despite the benefits of exercise, I don't even have enough time to exercise as much as the guidelines say. But there's many other feasible and effective approaches that can fit in many different lifestyles. And so some of it is getting over this message that we were always given. And men are given the same message, but I think it's more less stereotypical for men to lift heavy weights, whereas women are told to walk and to burn calories and, you know, a lot of that fat burning zone, when in reality, like, you burn more fat by lifting heavy, by doing high intensity work. And like you mentioned, you have better bone integrity if your muscle is pulling on the bone, and you do that. It's not sufficient just to walk.
I think especially as people do get older, it's trying to communicate the message of the benefits of why muscle mass is important. Because I think from a general societal point of view, you know, people with big muscles, they're still kind of seen as maybe the wannabe bodybuilder or a bit of a meathead. Could you talk a little bit about, specifically from a female health and wellness perspective here, what are the benefits of women having more muscle mass? Because I think we get caught up in the message of you need to tone muscles, whatever this kind of tone means. What are the actual benefits for women to try and increase their lean muscle mass, both in the short term and over the longer term?
Well, and I like this question. So I'll say the benefits are the same for men and women, that muscle is directly related to health and quality of life. And I think people forget that. And I'll take that one step further. Like the best way to prevent diabetes and, cardiovascular disease is to have better and higher quality muscle. And so when we think specifically about females, there's a couple things that that are a bit unique, especially as women transition to kind of peri and postmenopause, is that we're seeing what we call greater anabolic resistance, which means that there's likely the muscle is less sensitive to proteins as they eat them or as we eat them. And so essentially we need a larger stimulus and or more protein to be able to maintain that muscle. And then we also see greater acceleration of bone loss in women related to some of those changes in hormones. And so if we think about one of the best impact on bone is resistance training and having that higher quality muscle. So that bone piece is a bit unique for the female. And so those, really things to think about. The other thing I wanted to throw in here too is that there's a unique aspect in women that our brains change pretty significantly with anxiety and depression and even mood and I would argue satiety. And so one thing that is the same for men and women is often as we age, we don't crave and don't, our palate is different for like proteins. We don't want those animal proteins as much. We also have less of an appetite, and women, you see the significant increases in anxiety and depression. And so the way I like to juxtapose that is if I'm constantly worried or I have those increased feelings, then I go back to what I was taught of, oh, I need to just like move my body. I'm unhappy of how I'm looking. At the same time, we have increases in fat mass and losses of muscle. And so then you have this like perfect storm of like, why would I eat more and exercise more when in reality I should be burning calories and targeting fat loss? But that's not working. That's not helping. We need to give these women some very practical and feasible approaches to tackle that.
So it's almost though what women need to do as they get older and they go through this phase of lifting heavier weights and eating more protein, their entire body, their mindset, well, however you want to define it, is almost steering them away from those things. It's saying you don't want to, you don't need to eat that, or you don't need to do this kind of activity. I guess that's my roundabout way of asking, how do we fix this? Is this purely an education play? Because it seems to be the people that would benefit the most from eating protein and lifting weights are the ones who are least inclined to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other element we have to make space for is that at the same time, particularly what I would call perimenopause is as women, that and that's generally 42 to 52, so it can last up to 8 to 10 years. We also see greater increases of fatigue and poor sleep. And so, I always view it from like those are also women at the peak of their careers taking care of everyone else. And so they don't have a lot of energy. And so when I think like very practically, okay, I gotta go, I need to like amp myself up to do some high intensity work or lift heavy. Like it's way easier to go for a walk and I have the energy to do that. And so I think we need to target it twofold. It's sometimes teaching women that, yeah, you once you get started, you have this release of, dopamine and like all these benefits, but it's getting to that point and that takes that extra push. And I mean, most of us know it's habit. And the earlier we can create some of those habits and just target it. So I do agree that some of it is education. I think particularly with women too, another element is everyone is having these feelings and symptoms. But nobody's talking about them. And so often women are like, oh, it's just me. I'm not going to say anything. This is just a me issue. And so I think some of it is doing these things, like making space and airing that this is evidence-based and women are all experiencing some level of these symptoms. And here now, how do we help them?
It seems as though there's a bit of a educational gap, maybe from the medical profession, because I wouldn't necessarily assume that women are going to their doctor and getting this kind of advice. Start deadlifting and start eating more steak is probably not what they're being told. So I guess my first question, how do we address the gap in the medical profession? And then also, how can we supplement that advice? It feels like social media is a natural place for a lot of people to go to this information, but then obviously we've got to police the quality of the information there. How do you see us bridging that gap between what women should be doing at this part of their life and how they can actually start doing it?
Yeah, I mean, I do think healthcare is one key thing. Like one thing we're trying to do here, and I know some other places are doing, but it really needs, like, women need a comprehensive healthcare approach. Meaning, oftentimes, let's say I go to my primary care, but when reality, I need an endocrinologist and I need a gynecologist and I need a physical therapist to help with urinary incontinence or whatever it may be. And so women are left to really find the right people. We need to put them all in and make it more accessible. And I absolutely agree that, and this is my biased opinion, but exercise is medicine. We need kinesiologists and physiologists in that healthcare model to be integrated. I would say nutritionists as well. And so that's one key element. I love social media, but I also hate it. For one, in reality, like everyone's showing their best self. And I think what I've seen more recently in the female space is people are trying to make a lot of money on things that don't matter. Particularly, oh, you need to, buy this app to train around your menstrual cycle. You need to buy these, natural supplements to help with, your vasomotor symptoms. In reality, like we need to get the information that they can use and what's like kind of dial it in, but that's, I do think social media has some of that. I also think that many of the key players, so I think about large organizations that have a direct pulse on education, can be really valuable. And I hope to see that in the future. Like one thing, I'm not brand agnostic, but I think about, for example, Gatorade Sports Science Institute is an international organization. And they have like free information. So can we have some of those outlets that have more funding to help provide some of that evidence-based information?
Just how frustrating is it for you when you're obviously very, very close to all this data? You know what the science is telling us. And there must be an awful lot of women that we all know who are probably a lot more unhappy or unhealthy than they need to be. And the solution is almost right at their doorstep. Is it a source of constant frustration that lifting weights and having a better awareness of what you should be eating, it's not going to be the whole way, but it might get people on that path to a far higher quality of life at a time of their life when they most need it?
I would say it's frustrating, but it's also really motivating. Meaning like we have the answers. Now we don't have all the answers and we need a whole lot more information. But I can't tell you how many people and women that a small conversation that if they can buy into it, they see pretty immediate results and they feel better. They have more energy. They value their body more. And so it's motivating in the fact that if we can get the information to the women, we know it works. There needs to be some fine tuning. But it goes back to like, why am I motivated to talk to you? Well, because it's more people like you. If we get more information out there, then someone will hear it, even, a couple women.
Is this something that men have a part to play in, whether or not we're husbands, partners, sons? I'm someone who's weight trained for a long time. My partner has got into it since meeting me and now probably does it as much, if not more, than I do. Just how much of a support, if men are watching this, what can we do to help the most important women in our lives take that first step and maybe better understand some of the things they can be doing from lifestyle intervention point of view to improve their quality of life?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all in it together. And I would say that men maybe even have a higher role. When I think about you, like you said, you either have a mom, a sister, a significant other. And often it's the man that sees how the woman is changing. And there are direct changes related to their mental health and physical health. And so, we all need some support, and that would look like different from different perspective. But depending on the skill and the conversation, a man could be a very good social support person and help them. Sometimes women are not sure what to do or how to eat, or that's too much food, or and so I think yeah, we all have a role. But the more information you have, or even having those evidence-based conversations with women in your life to say, "Hey, I've noticed this. Have you tried this?" or even sometimes I need motivation of like, oh, I'm too tired to train today. And, my spouse will say, like, just go. It'll take 20 minutes. Just go do something. And then afterwards, I feel so much better. So I think sometimes it's, oh, actually, this would be better. Instead of walking, like, go take 20 minutes and do something a little bit higher intensity or heavier lifting.
Especially with men, I guess a lot of men may be a little bit more comfortable in the weights room, whether through college, university, it's a familiar environment. I still think in my anecdotal conversations, the gym can still be quite an intimidating place for women, and I don't think men don't necessarily do a great job of welcoming other people into the gym. I think that's somewhere, and I'd be fascinated to get your thoughts, how this can be something that only you do with your partner, but perhaps your kids as well, getting them used to that environment, which could typically be a high testosterone environment, shouldn't be, and certainly hopefully won't be moving forward, so we can get not only our partners and significant others, but also our kids more involved in physical activity.
100%. I think the other thing that we study a lot is something called high intensity resistance training that doesn't need a lot of equipment. And so even I think one of the benefits of COVID is, you know, people are doing a lot more activity, whether it be virtual or doing things at home. And so again, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing approach. And I think that sometimes is a barrier for people. So get a few heavier weights at home, and that's something where, you know, you could ease into, and it's cheaper often. Than doing, you know, a gym, or like I'm a mom with two kids. It's hard. It would be hard to find time to go to the gym. And so really saying like we need to create this environment where there's a lots of different options that work for different lifestyles that can still have benefit, opposed to you need to, you know, exercise 150 minutes a week and twice a week per resistance training. Like that's not feasible for most people, particularly women. Often, you know, this is stereotypical, but we have other invisible labor and other things that are on top of some of what men deal with. Not always, but
With say someone, a woman's watching this and she's never done any type of resistance training at all, what's your advice? What are the first one, two, or three things someone should do to, I guess, gain the confidence if that's a stumbling block, or to gain some understanding? How can someone transition from someone who doesn't lift weights into someone who does, and most importantly, who loves it?
yeah, I mean, I would actually say I would start with some high intensity interval training. Although that's not weights, it's a bit more, you don't need a lot of equipment. And we know, particularly my lab has shown that that increases muscle mass more than like just aerobic exercise. And so that would be step one. And then I think depending on the woman is ask themselves, like, what do you need? Do you need someone to go with you? Do you need someone to show you how? You know, do you need equipment? And then, you know, giving that woman some, you know, justification to say, like, put money toward yourself. Like, this is very much, you know, often women don't want to pay for a trainer or for a gym membership or ask someone to go with them. But this is a direct, like, I can't emphasize this more. We know that if you do this now, it directly improve your health and quality of life as you age. It will reduce your risk for a number of diseases. And so, you know, women often put it off. Oh, I'm not, you know, I'm selfish, or I'm not going to do that, or I don't have the time. When in reality, like a little bit of time and a little bit of investment will have a significant impact on our health and quality of life.
From a female hypertrophy perspective, both looking at training, nutrition, and supplementation, if we begin with the training, what are the key differences in terms of program optimization and regime planning that a woman would need to consider that's different from a man? Are there any big differences? Are there a lot of similarities? I was really hoping you could talk about what are the key principles behind hypertrophy training in women.
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say right now we don't have a lot of evidence to suggest that it's any different. And so, one, I want to remove that barrier. I would say at this point, just start lifting. I think I would qualify that if we're talking about an elite female, we might want to, you know, to take some of those things into consideration. And I think there is some evidence to suggest some alterations across the menstrual cycle. But nothing that's dramatically going to impact hypertrophy. And so like it's little things like your sleep may be impacted, or your volume, or you may be more sore. And so this is maybe an unpopular opinion, but I think if anything, it comes down to nutrition. You lift a muscle, it's going to adapt, and you lift it consistently, it's going to adapt. Will it respond exactly the same as a male muscle? I mean, I think there's a lot of things that go into that. And so I don't think we need to get into the weeds. Like the women need to just lift and that you will respond. However, you won't respond if you're not eating enough, if you're not timing around your workouts, and if you're not recovering. And those are, I think, some of the elements that we can do better and help our women better.
And what should be the key considerations then for women in terms of nutrition around hypertrophy and lean muscle mass gain? What are women doing wrong? What do they need to do better? Where are the easy wins? Give us an overview of the nutritional needs.
This also may be unpopular, but we women should not be fasting. And so fasted exercise is particularly harmful for women, meaning they won't see effects and they won't recover. And so some of the evidence that we have in some other labs is that women may benefit actually from a pre-workout nutrition intake. So never go underfueled into training. And what that would look like is actually some protein prior to exercise can show greater volume and greater changes to the muscle, which is really against the grain. Like even I was a collegiate distance runner, even to this day, like why would I eat before I'm going to go burn calories? Like that goes against everything I was taught. But in reality, it gives you nutrients to fuel your muscle, recover, and really accelerate protein synthesis. And so if anything, tell a woman not to fast and to have a small amount of protein prior to exercise. That would be my number one.
And just on the intermittent fasting or going in on a fasted workout, how much do we understand about the physiological mechanisms that are behind why? Are we saying it's a neutral effect or is it actually a negative effect to go in fasted?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the scenario, but like if we are take our typical female whose goals are to gain muscle and maybe lose some fat mass, intermittent fasting will be harmful in that respect. And depending on the scenario, if you do it once or twice, it's not harmful. It's more like negative or like a neutral response. But a lot of women put themselves in the scenario and then you feel terrible while you work out. And so there's some residual of like, well, then why would I go work out? I felt terrible last time. Depending on the spectrum, I would say it becomes more negative as the older the woman gets, particularly impacting immune function and bone and muscle. And so the question goes back, like, why would we make it harder for ourselves? Just have a little fuel beforehand. But it's more complicated than that because what I've always been told, well, don't eat before you exercise, like exercise more, eat less. When in reality, it's prioritizing the food around your workout so that you can maximize those benefits and your body can really utilize those elements of those macronutrients.
And sticking with nutrition from a more a daily macro point of view, are there any other considerations? Are more dietary fats more important? Obviously, protein is important, but where does that rank in terms of the importance and where women might be missing a trick in terms of hitting those macro needs?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many fad diets, it's hard to blanket it to women, but some elements that I always kind of call to attention when we talk about dietary fats, it's really about the essential fats. And when we talk about mood and inflammation and overall kind of health, none of us are getting enough essential fats, so our omega-3s particularly. And so all of us need more of that. It also helps our hair, skin, and nails. Many women are taking, supplements for that when in reality, like that omega-3 can really benefit that as well as brain health. So many women are afraid of carbohydrates. And, sure, some of our refined carbohydrates will, we can minimize, but it's really coming from our, higher fiber foods, our fruits and vegetables. Those provide a lot of value, like vitamin C and antioxidants that help with collagen and just inflammation. And so, what I would like a takeaway I would tell most women is eat multiple times throughout the day. That's going to vary based on, how many calories you need. But every time you have a meal or snack, have at least 30 grams of protein and pair it with a vegetable or a fruit and get in some water. That doesn't mean don't have, your rice and your potatoes and, the delicious carbs that no one needs a reminder to eat. But if we start to prioritize, that 30 grams of protein and a fruit and vegetable, it does tremendous things for not only our muscle, but also our gut, which is impacted, our brain. So, and it's not hard. You don't have to eat like certain foods. It's just being a little bit more cognizant of those spacing throughout the day.
And I guess trying to slip off the shackles of the mentality of eat less, right? I think it's so ingrained in both men and women now. But actually, it's not about the quantity you're eating; it's about the quality of the food. That's going to be the most important thing. I think moving on, supplements is something that you've researched extensively, specifically creatine in women. I'd love to talk to you about some of the supplementation strategies that women can deploy to, I guess, both build and then maintain lean muscle mass, maybe starting with creatine, because I think it's something that generally women tend to shy away from, maybe because of the water retention, the bloating, some other potential side effects. What's your research told you about the benefits of creatine supplementation amongst women?
Well, yeah, let me just make a one blanket statement. Like, I'm a big believer in whole foods, but in reality, particularly women, you just can't eat enough and get everything through food. And so, when I started in this business and I was a college athlete, I didn't believe in supplements. And let me tell you, I had a lot of injuries and poor recovery. There is a role for specific supplements, particularly for women, and creatine is one of those. And the reason I say that is as with anything, we kind of always want to weigh the risk to benefit ratio. And with creatine in particularly, it's low cost and has minimal risk with potentially high benefit. And what are those benefits? I mean, I think if we talk about active women, there are some performance benefits, meaning you can do a little extra volume. I'm not super, like, okay, great. Like that's cool. But it's all the other benefits. So for actually one study just came out that if you combine creatine with resistance training, it's particularly beneficial for maintaining and possibly increasing bone mineral density in women. And so, beyond some of the other supplements, it's effective for increasing muscle mass, which has a direct relation to, health and quality of life. I think it's very fascinating to see the potential benefit on mood and brain. And so there's some interesting data that shows that in low-grade anxiety and depression, creatine actually helps SSRIs work better or just helps improve those symptoms. And so, we know those symptoms are higher in women. And so creatine could be one of those first lines of defense to help women feel better mentally. I'm here for that, right? Anything that's natural. So that's an element too to think about. And there's a couple other things, but those would be the top. And one study that we just looked at too, there is no weight gain in women, and that's been consistently showed. But we particularly looked at it across the menstrual cycle because there are weight fluctuations across the menstrual cycle. And creatine does not cause any, it's about a half a pound increase. And it's actually a beneficial half a pound. What we noticed is that it helps pull water into the muscle, which may have some implications for preventing dehydration. And most of us are dehydrated. And so there is real no downside to it, particularly too when you look at all of the potential benefits and the cost.
I was just going to say, until you took the words out of my mouth, in terms of the benefits versus the very, very low cost, would this be your number one supplement for women to take? Or are there others that are going to have, I guess it's all a cumulative effect, right? What, aside from creatine, if it is top, what else would you have in your list?
Yeah, I know. I do. Creatine is often the top, particularly like I think the element that I always like to bring up is your body makes creatine from different amino acids in the body, but it's hard to eat that much protein to get the same. And so I also realize that most women don't like the sedentary powder at the bottom of a glass. And so, depending on the woman, maybe I wouldn't recommend that first, depending on, her introduction into the supplement world, but it would be one of the top. I would say some like lower, not lower risk, but I would say less scary ones. Vitamin D is very essential for women. And then omega-3, those would be kind of my top ones just to start out. But then obviously there are others that I would recommend.
Testosterone plays such a huge impact in muscular strength and endurance, and is one of the main reasons why men are typically, bigger, stronger, faster than women. What else do we know about some of the other underlying psychological reasons for the difference in the sexes between strength, power, endurance? How much do we know about that?
That's a loaded question. There are some differences when we think physiologically. Testosterone is just one small piece, and women have testosterone. And one of the benefits of resistance training is we do have some increases in testosterone. It's not nearly like what a male would have, which is why we can't build as much muscle. But a couple other things to think about is women are what we call more fatigue resistant. And often are able to potentially, they have more type 1 muscle fibers, which leads into that fatigue resistance and some potential differences with blood flow and kind of removal of metabolites. And so One key question that we're trying to look at is how would that impact exercise program and design? We don't know that yet, but it just comes down to, women aren't going to respond necessarily differently to the same training method. But what we might want to start thinking about as we get more data is, do we need to change like the work to rest ratio? And speaking from someone like we study males and females in the lab, and women always, they can get through the hardest protocols, and men are often on the ground, like cannot do it. And it's not like a mental resiliency thing, it's a physiological thing. And so I think a couple of things, to empower the women is like we can do hard things. And at the same time, like we need to advocate to get more data to say, should we be doing it differently? And to me, it's mind-blowing that it's 2023 and we still don't have those recommendations. And so that's one of the things, like even as an active woman is, oh, should I start doing some things different as I age? And the answer is yes. Like I think we know that your body adapts quickly, you have a lot of fatigue resistance. And so if you're not seeing changes or you see your body changing in a way that it hasn't, start to do things differently. Increase the intensity, increase the load, shorten the rest, do an activity that you're not very good at, for example, swimming, rowing, whatever it may be. Because your body will respond the best to that.
Are there any considerations around recovery, the long-term recovery after the session? Because at my understanding, some of the performance-enhancing drugs benefits aren't directly to do with the building bigger muscles or faster or being able to be faster or stronger. It's much more to do with the volume of work you can do. You just recover quicker when you're taking those substances. If men have higher, testosterone levels, is this something we need to be aware of when kind of planning and structuring recovery and rest periods for women?
I would say generally, yes. I don't think it's a testosterone thing. So, for example, I think it's likely impacted by progesterone as well as things like sleep. And so, one thing that we're seeing and trying to dial this in a little bit, but for example, in the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle, when estrogen and progesterone are high, we often see kind of slower recovery potentially or greater protein turnover and, some greater fat oxidation and protein use. So one of the recovery pieces comes in is if you're not sleeping well and you haven't fed recently, you may take longer and be more sore. Also in that phase, we tend to have a slightly higher metabolic rate. So like we burn an extra 300 to 400 calories approximately. So then that exacerbates, like if I'm already under fueling, but now my metabolic rate is a little bit higher, yeah, I'm going to be more sore. I'm gonna, have some low caloric intake, and that also impacts sleep. So, yeah, I mean, one of the things I always say is every woman is different, just like a man. But the first thing that we should be doing as women is knowing when is your menstrual cycle? When are you menstruating? When are you ovulating? At what point of your cycle are you in? Becomes harder as you go into perimenopause, but women, many of them don't know. They don't know. When any of that is happening, and when you start to realize it makes a lot of sense. Oh, like, no wonder I feel way more sore and fatigued right now. Like, I'm in my luteal phase, or like, I feel so good right now. Well, it's because I'm ovulating. And so, like, empowering women to say, like, you actually can learn a lot about your body when you start asking more questions and understanding, like, what's going on hormonally.
Yeah, how excited are you by the new technology coming down the road in terms of AI, trackables, wearable, smart tech that is going to hopefully shine a light for women to know how they're doing, not just a kind of general awareness, but actually what their body is doing? Is this something that could be a game changer in terms of, better training, better recovery, better nutrition, greater health and happiness?
I would say yes, like it is very exciting. However, I also say it's a bit frustrating right now because people are weaponizing it, meaning you have these camps of like, oh, you should change your training across your menstrual cycle, or oh, you should absolutely not. When in reality, like I think the conversation is so great. Now women can, be a part of it. But at the same time, a lot of women have, severe menstrual cycle symptoms that does impact, training. Or now there's excuses, or I've seen recommendations, oh, you shouldn't do anything high intensity in the luteal phase because of, it's adding somewhat of an element of more barriers for women. And now, making more money off of women that want the help. And so I think there is a lot of potential benefits, but I still think it will never be overpowered by education and the right education of let's get the information and recognize like in reality, everyone should be able to exercise at any point of the menstrual cycle, or as you're, transitioning to menopause. But let's have more conversations of what to do if you're not feeling as good, if you have some more inflammation, or you're not recovering as well. That doesn't mean don't exercise. It's how is that looking? So yes, I think the technology has a lot of potential benefit, but it needs to grow a little bit.
What does the research tell us about performance optimization in different stages of the menstrual cycle in terms of strength, power output, endurance, recovery, sleep, all these other things? I totally get what you're saying about we shouldn't introduce barriers to people, but obviously some people will want to be able to optimize how they train, recover, and all these other things. What does the science tell us about what we know, and how can someone then extrapolate that information into their own training and their own recovery?
That is a $1 million question, if we're being honest. We don't know yet. I mean, I think there are some things that we can do, particularly for our elite athletes. So the ones that have dialed in a lot of those things and really need some small elements of change. But in reality, like, you're never going to change when you compete. You might need to change or slightly lower training volume, or, it's very individual. I wouldn't do a lot for the general population. And I think, the other big space that we have to realize is that 60% of women, particularly in the US, use some form of hormonal contraception. So although we have this beautiful picture of a menstrual cycle, that translates to very few women. And so then how is it impacted by things like PCOS or hormonal contraception or an IUD, which a lot of more women are using? And so there isn't a good blanket response. It still goes back to individual data from the female to understand how is sleep impacted, how is your training, and really understanding, because women will respond differently, particularly based on the type of contraception that they're using. And the data right now, I think that's the big piece. Obviously, I'm a nerdy scientist, but we do need more data. And it goes back, like, at the minimum, we can be altering nutrition. I would not change training a whole lot. There are some things to do if you have, tracking training volume and some of those things that you would alter to maximize recovery. But to me, the first line of defense is nutrition. And somehow that's being overlooked because we still need more information on exactly how performance is impacted and based on contraception and, the menstrual cycle, and then let alone something like perimenopause when your hormones are different every day.
Again, is this something where technology and AI can help? Because I think a lot of people won't understand or appreciate that just how much of the science that has been done on men, typically young men already who are quite healthy and fit, and there just hasn't been the spotlight shone on women. How far have we got until we catch up to that there is the data sets that you can start working with and really getting some useful information from? Or is that something where AI simulations, other tech are going to have to run some of the data to help get you up to speed, because there's just such a lag between the male data we have and the female data we have.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think AI can provide a lot of intuition, but we need some baseline data for it to, create the algorithms. And I would say, one thing, not only is the data only in men, the funding for studying women is way far behind. And so, I think to maximize the benefit of this technology is that we do need actually real human data to help create some of those recommendations. And that needs to be accelerated. And there's a lot of debate about how we get that data and translate it. But that would be still a pretty big missing link before we can, really maximize this technology. But I love where your head's at, and I think that's where we can go. It's creating some of that foundational data to understand. If you look at most of the papers out there right now, there's definitely an influx in data in women. But collectively, most of it says, like, oh, it wasn't done right, or we don't have enough, or it's too early to tell, which there's something to be said about that. But there's very few labs that are actually, like, trying to create the data, and there's very little money to do that. And so I think it's this open conversation of, yes, technology is great, but it's only as good as the data you're creating, the information on.
With the perimenopause, Can you explain some of the changes that a woman is going through and how that directly impacts her ability to exercise, to recover, to sleep, in the nutritional stuff that we've talked about as well? What are the main things that are going on that somebody who's entering that stage, or the partner of somebody who's entering that stage, really needs to know?
All of it, Joe. Like, I'll explain it this way. A lot of people are aware of postmenopause, but postmenopause is a single point in time when, after a woman has lost her menstrual cycle for 12 months. And what we see is actually postmenopause, things get better. It's pretty stable. Like, almost like women are feeling better. Perimenopause is this time of disarray. You could feel different every day. Your body is dramatically changing, and often you don't know why. And it's not just your body, it's also your brain. And so it's to me, and the other data should support this, is that it's the most important time for behavior change and taking care of your health. But think about that. That's typically like 42. Average age of menopause is 52. So you have this 10, like think about most women in that time frame. It's often hard to like take a step back and say like, oh, maybe I'm feeling this way because of perimenopause. And oftentimes the changes are slight, and so, or some days you're feeling worse than others. And so it goes back to tracking menstrual cycle, understanding that, and having like what I always recommend is any woman in their early 40s should get a baseline blood panel. What do your hormones look like? What do all of these, like your cholesterol, what is a baseline for you, so that you then can track it? And I think it's a great conversation to have with whoever you're living with, or friends, or someone in your family. Like, because sometimes it's not physical, it's mental. I'm having more anxiety or depression, or a term out there is brain fog. That's really hard to capture. Like, how I'm just not thinking the same. And so, talking through, especially as those change, can provide space to like, you're not crazy. Like, these things are happening. And that's why I also love some nutritional things. Like, I think that there's a huge potential impact of nootropics in this age range to target some of those mental health changes, which are really hard to capture, and for women to realize, like, oh, actually, I'm not crazy. Like, there's things happening, and what are some things that I can do to help, which then directly impact my energy, my sleep, my ability to do anything for myself and to exercise.
In researching my conversation with you, I tried to find as much really good quality advice for people for women in the perimenopause around training, nutrition, supplementation. And I really struggled to find, there's obviously isolated pockets of good stuff out there. There's a lot of information that maybe didn't stand up to much scrutiny. Dr. Smith Ryan, why do you think there is a dearth of quality information for such a huge issue that affects 50% of the population? And then following on from that, what are the big stones in terms of training, nutrition, and other strategies that a woman going through this could look to employ to try and make herself feel better?
That's a great question. I think some of it falls in the fact a lot of women don't know when they're starting to in perimenopause. And then it's not been, so we obviously research women, and oftentimes it's hard to identify, is a woman in perimenopause, and then can they provide their time to come into a lab or to provide their data? But then you're right. There's not a lot of information out there because we don't have a lot of data to provide that information. Hopefully that's changing. And then as far as like key takeaways for these women, it really goes, like, I would say first and foremost, prioritize yourself. And what I mean by that is it will matter more. So like, make the time for exercise, even if it's a short, heavy resistance training. If you don't know how to do it, pay for someone that will help you. I would invest in your dietary intake. It doesn't have to be anything crazy and cost a lot of money, but making some small changes. And a lot of it, like, it's easy as a woman to say like, oh, I'm just going to skip lunch today, or I'm going to feed everyone else. But it's prioritizing you and prioritizing what you're eating and how you're taking care of your body, because that will absolutely directly impact your health. So those are, and the other thing too is like really making space for so many women are experiencing the same things, and it's really frustrating that there's not an expert that they can go to, like, for example, a medical professional. But I would say, like, keep searching. There are some out there, and asking more questions, so that some of this, so that they can find answers, opposed to, like, sometimes it's frustrating, you know, no one has the answers, or where do I go? But I think there's more of that coming now, of like, oh, here, go to this endocrinologist, or your gynecologist might have more information. So kind of pushing that, like, not just giving up, or letting, I guess, taking some ownership in your health.
There's a lack of clear and good science and research around women from a sports science point of view, not just perimenopause, but at different ages as well. There's also a real lack of women in science generally. You're obviously an exception to that rule, but are you seeing this move in the right direction towards encouraging and helping more women come through into this space? Or do you feel that we're actually taking a step backwards and we're not seeing some of the changes that we hope we would have done by now?
I think both. I think so, particularly in when we talk about the, you know, exercise physiology or sport nutrition space, we still have a lot of very young females that are, and more of them in our master's and PhD programs, but they don't often make it through. And that's because of some of the, you know, traditional barriers that we still have in academia and in science. I also have seen a very big influx in what I call, kind of data picking, or it's much harder to actually publish research in this space now in women, because it doesn't meet this certain standard. Like, you would never say that, that the male data doesn't. And so the other element too is, you know, and I can say this as a young female in a male dominated field, is it takes a lot of resilience, and it does for a man too. But at the same time, sometimes women are harder on each other. And so it's also, to me, as a female in the space of opening up doors and helping the women around us, versus, you know, sometimes we make it harder on each other. And so it's really, like, it's going to take a huge effort, and we've made some progress, but it's having more conversations like this, opposed to, like, you know, one thing I always say is, my husband's in academia and we have the same job, but our lives look so dramatically different. And so having these conversations of, what does your life look like? How do you have a family? How do you get through the hard parts? Like, what are strategies that work versus what don't work? And often things like, why would we talk about such touchy-feeling things in, you know, your career? But it really matters, especially to know how to navigate and how to, like, kind of break some of those barriers.
One of the things when I do speak to women in science and even business to an extent is a theme that comes up that has never come up in a conversation with a man of a similar role is imposter syndrome. And it seems to be something that seems to affect women more than men. I'd love it if you're okay to talk about it. Is that something that you've ever had to deal with? And if so, how have you overcome it?
100%. I mean, men deal with it too, but oddly enough, my imposter syndrome has grown more. So, like, I'm a full professor, and there's days that I feel like I'm a terrible researcher in person. And I think it goes back to, like, we just view ourselves differently as women. And we have just the way our brains work and the things that we prioritize. So yeah, I deal with imposter syndrome almost on a daily basis. How do you get through it? I don't know if I have a good answer for that, but I think it's, you know, surrounding yourself with good people and having good mentors, and, you know, depending on the space that you're in. I think so. Academia obviously is where I come from. It's full of a lot of negative feedback all day, every day. Paper rejected, reviewers' responses, someone not agreeing with you. And so I think it's viewing, what are the positives? What are, you know, it's a lot of self-work. You know, I'll make space. Like, I think everyone should have some therapy in their life. Like, there are some strategies that can help. Believe it or not, exercise is a great strategy for me, you know, kind of that consistency of control of what I have control over of my life, and what helps, you know, there's a lot of endorphins that are released.
And how much are you still seeing you and female colleagues butt up against the old school misogyny of men saying, you know, you can't go away and have a baby, then come back, or you're other things, you know, you're trying too hard, you're not trying hard enough, you're too emotional. Are you still encountering these reactions and these comments? You're nodding your head. How often are you coming up against it?
Almost on a daily basis. And I think sometimes it's those direct comments, and other times it's not comments at all. So, for example, I have two small children, Yet, you know, like I have to figure out childcare so I can go speak at a conference, or, you know, like if my spouse and I are at a conference, like I have to figure that out. Like there's a lot of things that aren't discussed, or maybe you're not going to get a, you know, after having kids, I got very few invites to give talks somewhere because they assumed like, oh, I have a newborn, I wouldn't want to go, or, you know, or small kids. And so I think it's not only are you getting those direct comments, it's the lack of conversation of how do we do this and let the woman decide, opposed to like, let's just not talk about it at all. Like, oh, a big elephant in the room is that you have kids. But the interesting statistic, there's this group, it's called Carry Media, and the amount of data that shows that working moms get more done and are more productive is actually quite impressive. But when you think about it, like, okay, well, why would they be more productive? And so I think it's having more of those conversations opposed to just like, oh, I guess they're, you know, that's their priority. And so, yeah, there's a it happens still every day.
There's only so much you can do by yourself, though, to overcome some of these obstacles. What steps or measures would you like academic institutions to explore or adopt to widen that funnel so we can have more women coming through into science and other disciplines that are traditionally dominated by men?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think we need to hire more women, which there's more women being trained. And, you know, I mean, at least in academia, they have more and better maternity policies than many other places. But it's also, you know, it's thinking about the intangibles, which goes the case, like the example I always give is like if a dad leaves a meeting to go pick up a kid, they often are considered like one of the best, most supportive dads. And then if a mom leaves, they're like, oh, she, you know, she's a hot mess. She can't, she's got to leave. And so I think it's creating some of those standards of, I mean, I think working flexibility, but conversations about how to also, I struggled a lot in academia at first of like, here you have home life and you have work life. When in reality, this is true for men too, but particularly for moms, like I never have that part of my brain turn off about like the home. It is this work-life harmony, and you have to like make space for that to realize like if we're going to support women, we have to realize like that their family is part of it. How do we integrate both so that everyone wins?
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.